Let's turn to this psalm then, and we're going to, first of all, take a look at the structure or the shape of the psalm. And it's very easy to identify the fact that this psalm is in two parts, because you have a chorus or a refrain that occurs in the psalm itself. So if you look at verse 7, you read there, "The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge." And then verse 11, "The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge." So that chorus neatly divides the psalm into two parts. What we'll do is we'll then look at the first part, which runs from verse 1 as far as verse 6. And then we'll see the second part of the psalm, verses 8 to 10. And this psalm sits in the middle of a number of psalms that describes the relationship of God to the world as a whole. So in our prayer earlier, we acknowledge that in the Old Testament, God chose one people for himself, the people of Israel, and God focused his revelation, his relationship with this one people. The rest of the world was left in darkness. And so the question arose, what is the relationship between God and the rest of the world? And this psalm is one reflection on that relationship. And God is described here as the God of Jacob. You can see in verse 7 and in verse 11 that this is the definition of God that the psalmist is using. So let's ask a question then before we get into the psalm itself. What sort of people is God interested in? Or if you like, what kind of people does God love? And the answer from this psalm is God is the God of Jacob. He is the God who is interested in men and women who struggle. The idea of the name of Jacob means somebody who struggles with himself, someone who wrestles with himself and with God. So God is interested in people who struggle with themselves and who struggle with him. And then you can equally say God loves those. He loves men and women who struggle. So this is the God that we meet in this psalm. And in the first section, you have a description, a very objective description, of what can go wrong and the response to it. So if you like, as we look at the first part of the psalm, we need to be thinking about the big picture. It's a description of the relationship between God and the world. Or if you like, you can think of the first part of this psalm as the big picture for you and how your life can sometimes work out. The second part of the psalm then is much more personal, and it begins with an invitation. So the second part of the psalm looks for a response to what we've already heard. So verse 8, "Come, behold the works of the Lord." And the second part of the psalm, whilst it's looking for a response, it's not looking for us to do anything. Now that's the crucial thing about the second part of Psalm 46. We have to struggle with ourselves, but one of the things we struggle with is a desire to do something. We always seem to want action. We either want God to act, or we feel that we ought to act. So the second part of Psalm 46 is a passive response. So you were looking, you can see that in verse 9, And then, of course, verse 10, a very famous verse. Be still. So this psalm is a call to the people of God to look to God and to be calm. The idea of stillness is the opposite of panic. Panic can be a response in which we think we have to do something. This is a call to look and to be calm. And the psalm gives us reasons for that. So let's start then with the first part of the psalm. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in times of trouble. Now that's an introduction. If you like, you can think of verse 1 simply as a title. It was just a few weeks back that we took the idea of God as our refuge. And the idea was from the book of Deuteronomy. God is our refuge and underneath are the everlasting arms. And do you remember we said then that this idea of God as refuge needs a storm to be true. So here's one of the references in Scripture to the fact that storm occurs. So the title then, God is our refuge and strength in a time of storm. And then you have two parts to this first section. So verses 2 and 3, they describe the storm. Therefore we will not fear, even though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though the waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. Can you see what you have here is that a description of the storm that the people of God are facing. And the psalmist very carefully breaks the storm down into four statements. The first statement is about the earth. Though the earth be removed. And the idea here is that the storm removes things that you've always taken for granted. So the idea of the earth, stable, permanent, fixed, everything is in its proper place. And then the storm comes along, and everything that seemed so permanent and so stable has been removed. It's a storm that takes away everything you've taken for granted. Now, as we go through the description of this storm, can you think of it in two ways? Think of the big picture. So if you like, there's a storm that is raging in the world as a whole, in society completely. But you can also see this as a storm within your own experience. So, for example, though the earth be removed, in terms of society, there have been things that we've always assumed will be there. Values that we've thought are permanent. There's been a stability and a familiarity about life that all of us have grown up with and we've taken for granted. Then comes the storm in society when the familiar is shaken and the comfortable is taken away and everything that seemed so permanent is about to change. So that's the first description of the storm. And then look at verse 2, and you have the second. Though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. Now here's a very poetic description of what a storm can be like. And it's the idea of everything being turned upside down. You would not expect to see a mountain in the ocean. You would think of mountains on land and then the sea as separate. But what the psalmist imagines is everything being turned around. Everything so shaken that things have become upside down. And that can be the storm that you experience in the world. So the world can become a place that suddenly seems to become upside down. What was once in one place is there no longer. Everything is turned on its head. Or personally, there can be times when our personal lives, things are turned on its head and things are upside down. Things aren't in their right place anymore. What was once there and taken for granted is gone, and then we find somewhere else in life the unexpected. We find something in an area of our lives that we never expected to be there. And it's puzzling and challenging and upsetting for us to find that place there. So do you see the idea then? Here's the storm being described. And whether you see it in big terms or in personal terms. And then verse 3, these two remaining statements of the storm. Though its waters roar and be troubled, and the mountains shake with its swelling. Now this idea then becomes, everything's on its head, the familiar is gone, and then even what remains in its proper place, even the waters and the mountains that are where they should be, even they don't seem as solid and as comforting as they once were. So here's this beautiful picture, a very poetic description of the storm in verse 46. So, the storm then. Then can you see verses 4 to 6 is a contrast. And the contrast to the storm is a city. And the picture here is the city of Jerusalem. And the idea is of the temple in Jerusalem, the presence of God, and then this river, the supply for the city. And you can see the contrast between the violence of verses 1 and 2, the destruction, the upset of those two verses, and then 4, 5, and 6, you've got this stable and peaceful presentation of the people of God. And as you look at verses 4 to 6, can you see how many times the name of God is evoked in these verses? You have the city of God, you have the presence of God, verse 5, then you have the activity of God in verse 6. God is opening his mouth and God is uttering speech. It's the idea that in this chaos and this changeableness and this uncertainty, there is God and there is his people. And God holds his people safe in the midst of such a storm. You have the presence of God right there with his people. Now, let me emphasize one or two things, if I can, about verses 4 to 6. Think of verses 4 to 6, then, as talking a little bit more about the idea of refuge. So you've seen the storm, verses 2 and 3. The title of the psalm is in verse 1. Verses 4 to 6 gives you more detail about the refuge, the idea of safety between God and his people. So God then is present right in the heart of the storm with his people. God is there. He's not going anywhere. He's not going to leave his people. He's going to be giving his people that permanence, that stability that the world cannot offer. So let's just choose two ideas then from verses 4 to 6. We do look at verse 5. And verse 5 says, God is in the midst of her. So there's the presence of God, and he's with his people right there in the storm. And the verse says, she shall not be moved. So think of that idea then with what we've already said. The mountains have been moved to the sea. Everything's turned upside down. Everything's on his head. The familiar has gone. There's been change. There's been unexpectedness. And then by contrast, there's God offering permanence and his presence to his people. And there's the contrast. So however much the world might turn upside down, however much you might lose in your own situation, whatever may change for you in the coming weeks, there is this permanent presence of God with you. And as you go down to the second part of the psalm, verse 8, what the response is, let's not look at what is changing. Let's not look at what's gone wrong. Don't focus your attention on how your world has turned upside down. Fix your gaze on what never changes. And what never changes is the presence of God with you and with his people. First thing then look at the opening words of verse 4. There is a river whose streams shall make glad the city of God. The idea here is of supply. Now, how can I put that better? It's the idea that no matter what happens, whatever goes on in the seas and in the mountains, however the storm rages, there will always be a supply for the people of God. There will always be the river, the stream, the grace of God available to his people to feed them and keep them and sustain them and uphold them, no matter what is going on around them. And so the people of God then, in the midst of all this chaos, can be sure that no matter what the chaos brings to them, God will continue to minister grace and strength and everything that the people of God might need. That's the idea here then. So I want to just sum up to make sure that we've made sense of this psalm. I'm not going to explain every verse. Let's just get a sense of the psalm. So there's a storm, there's chaos, uncertainty, unfamiliarity. Everything's shifted. The goalposts have moved. Things seem to be changing all around. But then in contrast, there is our God. There is the presence of God with his people. And that presence is permanent. So however much things change, there is a permanence of the presence of God with his people. And then there is a constant supply through this idea of a stream in verse 4. So that no matter what else goes wrong, you can be sure that God is sufficient for you. So whether you look today, as I do, on the big picture, how much the world has changed. We were talking last night as a family about how things have changed so quickly for us as a society. In our own lifetime, the change has been incredible. Or whether you're thinking about your own life and how things are upside down for you. However you interpret the storm, The idea is, God is permanent, he's permanently with you, and he will provide for you. He will provide whatever it is you need in whatever situation you find yourself. Well, let's look at the second part of the psalm. Verses 7 to 10, I guess, 8 to 10. Verse 8, come behold the works of the Lord, who has made desolations in the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariot in the fire. This is the imagery of war. And this imagery is building on one of the lines of the chorus. So do you remember now? The chorus is verse 7 and verse 11. And the first line of the chorus is the Lord of hosts. And the Lord of hosts compares God to a commander of an army. And it's the idea that God is riding to war, and he rides on the army of the angelic host, if you like. So the heavenly powers, the mysterious realm, God is in charge, and he's commanding his army. The idea is of the power and the might and the strength of God. And I wonder sometimes whether we lose sight of this idea of the strength and the might of God. We focus, don't we, quite rightly, on the love of God and the compassion of God and the grace of God. But what matters to the psalmist is the idea of the might and the power of God. I guess it's because of the storm that rages around him. He's keen to see that we are not serving a God who loves but is too weak to do anything about it. So he has this poetic description of the might of God in the second part of the psalm. And he's inviting the psalmist. Can you see it there? The word come in verse 8. He's inviting the psalmist to consider the might and the power and the strength of God. So let's do that for a moment then. If you and I were to think about the power of God, where would we look today? So in Israel of old, they would look to the idea of armies and battles. For the New Testament Christian, if we want to see the power of God, we look to the resurrection. And it's the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. It's the raising of Christ from hell, from death, from Satan. It's the might of God displayed there that encourages us to think about the power of God. And the idea of the power of God here is in contrast to how weak we feel. So go back to part one of the psalm. And can you see at the end of verse 5? God shall help her just at the break of dawn. This is another poetic reference to our feelings of weakness. Everything is dark. We cannot find our way. Things seem to be at the blackest point and the darkest moment. When we feel weakness, we sang it, didn't we, in the version of the psalm that we had a minute ago. When we are aware of how weak we are, whether on a personal level, we are trying to deal with the challenges that we face, whether we are thinking about the struggles we have, like Jacob, with ourselves, we struggle with sins or doubts or fears. As we know our weakness, this psalm invites us to behold the strength and the power of our God. Perhaps we need it as a church. We are aware of our weakness, aren't we, as a congregation. We talk about our age. We talk about our numbers. We talk about where's the future leaders going to come from? Where will the workers come from? We are aware of our weakness. Now, this psalm is an invitation to consider the might and the power and the greatness and the bigness and the majesty and the awesomeness of our God. That's the idea here then. So if you feel weak individually, if you feel weak because of the storm, everything's turned on its head, if you feel weak in relation to yourself or as a congregation, come behold the strength and the might and the power and the majesty of our God, who can turn the most tragic situation. That's the idea here, isn't it? Verses 8 and 9. He can turn what looks impossible to us even around and to cease. That's the idea there. And then we come to verse 10. Now, I want to end with verse 10 because it is justly famous. Verse 10, be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. This is the verse, I think, that has impressed itself upon me more than any other in this psalm. And this is the verse that really lies behind my desire to look at this psalm today. Be still and know that I am God. We lose sight of God. In the midst of all the storm, we lose sight of God. And I think on a personal level, I think as a church, I'm not criticizing, I'm simply describing. We lose sight of God. So God invites us. Now, he doesn't invite us when we are all calm and it's all blue sky. Don't forget, this is a psalm against the background of the most upending storm you can imagine. And when a storm is raging, you want to rush around. So here's the invitation then. Be still and know. Now, the idea of knowing here has the idea of appreciating. It doesn't mean to know the fact of God. It doesn't mean to have your doctrines at your fingertips. It means to appreciate. Now, this is going to sound very bizarre, and I'm not able to say it any better. It means to appreciate the godness of God. Now, how can I say that any better? What is the fundamental truth about God? If you were to have one sentence in which you were to say, what's fundamental about God? This is what verse 10 will tell you. I am God. This phrase takes you back to Moses and the burning bush. This phrase takes you on to Jesus. I am the way, the truth, the life. It is the basic truth about God. And it's so wonderful that it's hard to grasp. I am God. And then what you have in the rest of verse 10 is God's determination and what God will do. So can you see verse 10? I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. God will ensure that this earth is filled with his glory. God will make sure that every human being will acknowledge him as God. Every knee shall bow, every tongue shall confess. God will make sure that every nation will acknowledge him. God will ensure that every human being comes before him in reverence and in awe. God will overcome all the obstacles, all the challenges, all the injustices, everything that stands in the way. God will overcome and God will be glorified. His name will be exalted and he will be honored and worshipped above all. This is who God is. This is what God is determined to do, and this is what is going to happen. Now, here's the invitation of Psalm 46. Come and behold, be still and know. God's great purpose is that he will establish his glory throughout all the earth, in every human life, in every situation, amongst every opposition. God will establish the glory of his name throughout all the earth, so that storms will cease, wars will end, opposition will be overcome. There is nothing that our God will fail to do in his purposes for his own glory. And what's helped me, I think, about verse 10 is this is God's purpose. God doesn't need me. He doesn't need me to advance his glory, or I can't get in the way of it. God doesn't need tabernacle to advance his glory, nor can we get in the way of it. If there are few or many, if there are weak or strong, if there's the rich or the poor, the wise or the foolish, God needs none of us to establish the glory of his name and the wonder and the glory of his purpose in this world. Our God is working everything at every level. That's your life, my life, society, nations, history. God is working it all for the exaltation and the glory and the magnificence of his name. We don't have a God who is weak. We don't have a God who's forgotten. We don't have a God who's impotent. We have a God who is present with us, providing for us, and we have a God who invites us. Be still. Stop the panic. Stop the focus on the storms. Don't dwell on how things are turned upside down for you. Don't keep your gaze on the shaking and the swelling. Look to God. This God who will be exalted, this God who will magnify his holy name, this God who is your God, and you are his people, be still and know that he is God. Well, let's pray, shall we?